I keep scheduling spaces, and then when I launch them, the Android app likes to close routinely, and then it kills everything, so then I have to just start a fresh one. So maybe scheduling is just a waste of time. Anyway, if you're listening to this recording, I'm going to go on mute for a good 5 minutes or so. So if you're listening to the recording, come back and, you know, skip forward 5 minutes and see if I'm talking. If not, come back 5 minutes later. I'm either going to start in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. It just depends on how fast I, like, reshare it out and make sure everything's in order, notes and stuff like that. So just hang tight, and yeah. Just checking in for anybody listening to the recording, or anybody planning to join. I'm getting there. Just a few more minutes or so before starting.
headset on as well. Just checking that is working. Looks like it is. Yep, we're by 7 or 8 minutes into this, just a couple of more minutes to go, and we will start. I'll start off by talking about some of my experiences with ransomware, so you all get a little bit of exposure to that experience and what it's like. Ransomware cases, that is, not the ransomware itself, but. So I'm probably going to wait a couple more minutes. I just, you know, I had to, I will kind of give the summary of the topics, though. Just trying to wait to see if anybody joins. Yesterday, I had some people join, but I had to restart the space and get it back out there. So we'll see. But in general, you know, I'll be talking, you know, mentioning some different variants of ransomware, you know, a group of ransomware service stuff, you know, different malware and tools used to get to the stage of launching ransomware, failures that we see in enterprises and companies, you know, topics around insurance, lawyers and stuff like that, and you know, and I'll give an example of, you know, one of the worst case scenarios that I've seen. We'll talk about kind of the flow from the very beginning to when they actually get ransomware. So that'll be the first topic, and the second topic is, you know, some high level tips on if you are looking to get into the cybersecurity space at an entry level. Some of the different roles you can look at, training, stuff like that. Yeah. Again, we'll get started in a couple of minutes. Okay. Sorry, let me cough. Right, it looks like we are going to get started here now. Okay, so we're at the 15-minute mark, probably 13 or 12-minute mark actually, because I had to restart the space. But anyway, let's talk about some ransomware. You hear in the news about, you hear every now and then some company in the news that was compromised, and they were attacked and had ransomware. Colonial Pipeline in the United States is an example. I think that was last year, if I remember right. That time just starts blending together sometimes, but there are a lot of other examples. Colonial Pipeline is just one of them. I think in the news it talked about how there was a group called Black Matter, or they also go by Dark Side, launched a ransomware attack on that enterprise. And what they did was they got the ransomware from a ransomware as a service provider called AlphaV, or they're also called Black Cat. So that's the thing about most malware, right? You typically have the people creating the malware, ransomware, whatever it is, and then you have the people purchasing that from those groups, right? Typically, when someone is attacking a company, they're most of the time, they have not actually created any of the malware that they're using. But what they're doing is they're creating a campaign. A campaign comprises, their entire plan. What ransomware they're using, what other tools are they using, credential harvesting, and so on. And we'll dig into some of that momentarily. But also, it helps you identify, what IOCs are there involved, what indicators of compromise, as the recipient of the attack, if you will. The person's entity, company, enterprise being attacked, you can use IOCs from threat hunting and threat research to prevent these things from happening, right? But anyway, so that, that's what happened there. I mean, that's kind of a general scenario for, getting that ransomware and how they're going to use it. So taking a step back, right? So just in general, walking through our a day a typical experience when we are called in. So what happens is we get a call from somebody saying, "Hey, we need you on a call in 5 minutes." Usually that's like 9 p.m. a Friday or some very adverse time usually. One time I was called at 5 a.m. on a Saturday to see if I could be in, Germany that evening, just as an example, not the actual country, but I did go across the world. I was there, I was in another country that evening and spent a few days over there helping out. But they'll call us, we'll hop on a call, and usually that call, they're calling us because they already know that they are compromised or infected. So we hop on a call. Usually there are just a ton of people, maybe people from other companies, but then a lot of people from their own company. Their administrators or engineers, maybe the help desk, security team, the network team. Usually you have your executives on the call too. Their CIO or CISO, which is Chief Information Security Officer, or So it's always a very tense and stressful situation, right? Because everybody is kind of on edge. They're very stressed out. They're compromised. They're trying to figure out how to stop this and resolve it, right? So it's understandable. So that's usually the first thing that happens, and then we get on the call. They're like, hey, so, usually we get two questions right off the bat, basically. Why didn't our security tools prevent this? Right? Which is already the wrong question, really, to start off with. So why didn't it stop it? And then the other thing, not really a question, but kind of a comment, they'll say, hey, we just got infected today or 3 days ago or 5 days ago, thinking that's their first exposure to any malicious attack, right? Where in actuality, the odds are that they have been compromised and had a bad actor in their environment to some degree for a very long time before that. On average, we'll typically see something like 6 or 8 or 10 months. So a bad actor using ransomware on your environment is not just doing that. What they're doing ahead of that is, those months and months beforehand, they're trying to get into your environment. They are trying to phish your employees. They are trying to, once they do get in your environment, they'll start using tools such as Mimikatz, for credential harvesting, or they'll use Cobalt Strike for spear phishing or emulating things or gaining access to different parts of your environment. Mimikatz is great for the credential harvesting. Cobalt Strike can do all sorts of things. But typically we see one and or both of those in an environment or something very similar, long before that ransomware case situation even began. What they're trying to get credentials, right? They want to gain access to your different systems. They want to try to get your storage devices, your Active Directory, your DNS servers. Maybe if you have your virtual environment, they'll try to access that. They'll try to get as much as they can. And they'll also, they're also trying to get domain administrator accounts and admin accounts with elevated privileges, through that credential harvesting. Some benefits to them of doing that, right? They can start accessing as much as they want. They can, maybe th they can also use that cr those credentials to, exfiltrate company sensitive company data. One reason they'll do that, the main reason they're trying to do that is because once they do get to the point of ra launching ransomware, if they do that, they encrypt your machines. By the way, what ransomware, all ransomware is a very basic thing. Really, all it's doing is, once it gets onto the system, it's just encrypting files, and that will require a decryption key to access again. They usually go for major folders, installation folders or user profile folders, trying to get all the user data encrypted, or they'll try to get onto the storage appliances. If they get to the storage where all that company data is, that's the best case scenario for them. But they're doing that so that, like I was getting ready to say, once they do launch ransomware, if they, are not successful in convincing you to pay the ransomware, because you've successfully backed up your data, you already have a business continuity or disaster recovery plan to get past this and recover in case this happened, then, then they can say, well, if you don't want to pay for that, we also have all of your sensitive data. If you still don't want to pay us, then we'll release that to the public, right? So it's kind of a backup plan for them to try to still get paid, right? So that's what they're doing there. And then, back to the first question that we always get about, why didn't the security software that we have stop this, right? It's typical, sometimes, nothing is perfect. Everything can be bypassed, right? To some degree. So there are sometimes flaws or failures in the security software itself, sure. But of all of my experience and the forensics teams I work with, all of their experience, typically it is something they're not doing right in their environment. They're not managing their domain administrator accounts correctly. For example, right? They, we've seen scenarios where, 14 different people will have the same domain administrator account with the same password, and they'll all use that on all the different appliances they're working on, respectively. Even more concerning, some of them will even use it just to log into their as their daily routine daily user into their machine, which is terrible, right? So that's something that's just an example of mismanagement of things, right? We'll also see things such as, their storage not being encrypted or isolated even correctly, right? So it's easy for that bad actor to access once they get to it. Poor Active Directory management, right? Cleaning up users. If you don't manage your systems and users appropriately, then you don't know what you don't know, right? You don't know what you have in your environment. You don't know what you don't have in your environment anymore. It's hard to manage that. If you don't have a norm, if you don't have a normalized view of your environment, it's hard to pick out the bad activity, right? So if you're not managing all the event information you're getting in, if you don't have a centralized logging solution to where all of your devices are feeding their events into one central area, you can't. It's very difficult to correlate information at that point. So it's hard to. We always like to use the word normalize, right? You need a normalized environment so that it's easy to just quickly notice all the normal, typically good behavior in your environment. So it's easier to pick out that bad behavior, right? Those are some of the downfall pitfalls we see as well. Then just some common things around, some things around not protecting the right stuff, right? So in their security software, maybe they aren't blocking or protecting against scripts, malicious scripts or fileless based malware, or launching these things through PowerShell, right? Using Base64 encoding and a string there. So that would be fileless based malware. They're not protecting against that stuff, which is commonly used, right? Or there might be options there to protect against specific malware or Mimikatz or Cobalt Strike, right? And it's just a simple rule to say, hey, enable this rule to protect against that. Sometimes, we've seen that just not enabled. Even more concerning, we see things such as just password protection not being able. So a lot of software security will have authentication methods like password requirements to uninstall the security solution or to even access it on the end user's computer, right? So then it can then be modified. I've definitely seen where that was not enabled plenty of times. And then what the bad actor is doing right before they're launching ransomware, they're running some script to go in there and use that domain administrator account, right, for example, or if there's just no password protection, to just go in there and uninstall the security solution, right? I've definitely seen that happen. Or just not having someone, it's always, especially in your higher profile businesses such as banks and hospitals and government and so on, you really need threat hunters, right? Threat investigators and people like that so that they're staying on top of these new threats, so that you can better protect your environment. If you don't know what the current happenings are, then how can you protect against that, right? Then we see, yeah, and a lot of time, there's a thing out there, there's a framework out there that's been out for years now, that's popular, very popular in the security community called the MITRE ATT&CK framework. And if you're not in cybersecurity, you're probably not familiar with that. But the MITRE ATT&CK framework is basically a set of TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures. These are based on tactics and techniques and procedures that bad actors use for malware, ransomware, launching campaigns, right? And knowing, so what happens a lot of times, people will say, hey, I have this event. Now, where does it map to in the MITRE ATT&CK framework? Well, taking that approach is really a reactive approach. You're saying, well, I already have the event. What TTPs in the MITRE ATT&CK framework associate to this? But at that point, it's just too late. So you can't really do anything with it. So you have to consider the MITRE ATT&CK framework when you're understanding it as a proactive mechanism. So understanding the TTPs in the MITRE ATT&CK framework and implementing protections against those before you actually get the events, right? Yeah, so that those are some of the process flows and challenges I see in ransomware cases or forensics cases, or we really call them incident responses or emergency incident responses, right? I should have mentioned that in the beginning. But some of the other, some other tidbit information that I wanted to mention that I find interesting is the paying of the ransomware part. Every time that a company pays the ransomware, they're just supporting the bad actors and their goals and efforts here, and they're just funding them to continue doing this. Even if it's easier for you to pay that ransomware and get out of that situation, the bigger picture is you're harming everybody else by doing this. So it's always our advisement to never pay the security, the ransomware, right? But then then another thing is, we usually have customers that have, sometimes they'll have cybersecurity insurance, and insurance is always it is a great thing, but just like every other traditional insurance, it comes with its problems, right? They tell you what to do. I've been on calls where we're getting ready to help a customer and they're ready to go, then their security insurance company says, nope, you can't have them. You have to get them off the call. We have to leave the call. Then they have to use whoever the security insurance is wanting to use for that forensics investigation, right? And that's not always a good thing. So security insurance is good, but it also has its downfalls as well, right? Then we also have, oftentimes we'll have lawyers involved, right? Not for, anything other than most of the time it's just standard procedure probably, right? But because then they have security insurance, right? It requires a lawyer probably, or if they fall under some sort of regulations or something, it'll probably require a lawyer. So then what will happen at that point, just as a scenario, the most annoying scenario we have to deal with is then where we then also ha we have to t sign a attorney-client privilege things for the customer to protect them. And then we have to get our attorneys and their attorneys involved. So, as a scenario, if I have something to share with them, with the customer, then I have to tell our attorney. Our attorney then has to tell their attorney. Then their attorney then has to tell them. If they want to respond, then they have to tell their attorney. Their attorney tells ours. Ours tells us, right? So it's like it's a very time-consuming thing to for communication, right? In an incident response or emergency incident response, a fast communication is the most is paramount, right? So when that ha I mean, sometimes that'll take hours to get messages through. I've seen it where it takes like over a day to get messages to and from, right? It's challenging. What else? Yeah, so the worst case I've ever been in, real quick, is I can't name any company names or any identifying information, obviously, because I'm under attorney-client privileges for customers, probably until the day I die. But anyway, we saw a case one time where the ransomware was so bad and had been in there for enough time. I think it was like a week or 2 weeks or something, which is already a very long time to not notice ransomware, right? But I guess the ransomware actors are slow and methodical about it. But anyway, it was so bad, and they launched the ransomware. They got the ransomware on so many critical devices, so many of their devices just in general. They didn't have any business backup, continuity plans. They didn't have backups procedures. They had no insurance, all this other stuff, right? It was just a very bad situation. It was so bad that they actually got to the point of making the ultimate decision of literally just getting rid of all their user computers, all of their appliances, all of their devices. They just left their data center completely. They moved to a new data center, bought all new equipment, all new hardware, all new end user systems, and really just built their environment from ground up, brand new. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen, and it was just a very difficult conversation to be a part of. But if you're into forensics investigations and stuff, I mean, there are a lot of cool things that come out of this. That would be one of the roles I mentioned when I get into the next topic. But I'm going to take a 5 minute breather, and we'll get back to it. So if you're listening to the recording, just skip 5 minutes and should be back. If you're listening to the recording, just 2 more minutes and we'll get going. Okay, I'm just reading something real quick and then we'll get started here. Let's see. Oh, Cardano over coffee. Did not realize that started. I am going during Cardano over coffee. Okay, great. Whoops. Yeah, right. So we'll go ahead and just get through this next part, and then I'll just hang on for the hour commitment, make sure to see if anybody hops in. As everybody knows, I run this for an hour at a time. Because I just really dedicate an hour of my time at a time. To just help people if they want to hop in for a minute and ask a question or something, right? Or hang out. So getting into cybersecurity, it might seem overwhelming, and I might even make it seem more overwhelming by my explanation, but let me tell you, it is not overwhelming. It's actually very exciting, very rewarding. And look, I've been in security for 13 years. And there has probably not been a day that has gone by where I have not learned something. And that's just wonderful. Nobody in this field expects anybody to know everything. The thing about cybersecurity is it's just an ongoing knowledge gaining field because there's just so much, everything is constantly changing. You have to have a good idea and a foundation of every aspect of IT. You don't have to have that starting out, right? We're going to talk about starting out in cybersecurity. So you really just need to understand the basics, right? But by getting into the field and staying in the field, you'll start picking all these things up. And the longer and the more you progress in the field, the more you'll need or want to know, and you'll just naturally know, right? It'll become something you just is natural, right? As long as you're a person that is, willing to put forth the effort, right? But the first thing, the obvious thing is training, right? Depending on your level of knowledge, start out with some training, like such as, the three places, there are plenty of places, but three I would suggest is Udemy, Udemy. And I'll, so Udemy is cool because, it just has a ton of wonderful videos. They do charge for them. I think there are some free ones probably, but most of the ones I do are charged, right? But you can time it right, right? So, for example, I was doing a Python course on there. Well, I went to look for it, and at the time, I think it was like, I don't remember how much, honestly. It could have been $40 or $50, or it could have been like 90. It was somewhere in the tens, right, range. But and then I saw it go on sale, and I was really busy at the time. I'm like, I'm not gonna do it. I'm gonna wait a little longer. Then it went back up again. I'm like, darn it, I missed my chance. Well, I was talking to the guy that told me about the course. He said, look, just wait, keep looking, right? And sure enough, not long from then, it went back on sale. And Udemy is a lot like my wife likes that store. I think it's called Home Goods. It's the one where basically half the store is always 50% off, and then they swap it out every week or however often they do it. Such a weird business tactic, but it works. So Udemy kind of does something similar where they mark things down a lot more. I think I paid like $3 for that Python course, or maybe a dollar. It was something stupid low. So just keep an eye on, find courses on Udemy you like. If they're not on sale, just keep an eye on them if you're in no rush and just wait for them to go on sale. You'll get good deals on them. Then you have LinkedIn Learning. LinkedIn Learning used to be a company called Lynda. So lynda.com, Lynda. Some years ago, I don't know how long ago now, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, LinkedIn bought lynda.com and it's now LinkedIn Learning. They also have a lot of wonderful courses on there. I cannot tell you the free fee structure on there. I don't remember. But that is another great option. Then YouTube. Obviously, YouTube. I use YouTube for everything. If I have a plumbing issue in my house, if I'm trying to do something on one of my off-road vehicles, things that I just have zero idea about, I'll find a YouTube video and it'll tell me how to do it. It's wonderful. There's a guy I've been listening to lately on YouTube, and I'm not sponsoring him. He's not sponsoring, or I'm not advertising or anything. I just like his content. Network Chuck. So he does all sorts of things. He talks about networking stuff. He talks about Linux stuff. He talks about all cool little different things you can do. I was watching a video one time. He showed how to easily build your own search engine. But recently, I watched a video on him about how to test out your systems for DOS and DDoS attacks, right? But anyway, YouTube as well. I guess some things I might recommend, and then also certificates, right? So there are three different types of things I would recommend start, three categories. The first category is looking up just IT topics, right? Understanding what the TCP IP stack is, understanding what ports and protocols are. Ports and protocols are, and what they are, and what they're used for, which ones are reserved, what are high ports, things like that. Knowing subnetting, right? Knowing how to understand IP addresses. It's probably safe to stick with IPv4. I have no idea if IPv6 will ever become a standard at this point. Maybe someday. But if you look on your routers at home and stuff, everything typically now does have an IPv4 and IPv6 address. And if you know what you're doing, you can actually force it to use IPv6. The difference with IPv6 is IPv4 had a limited amount of addresses when it first came out. One second. Okay, I think I had an incoming call. I don't know if that messed up audio, but I should be good again now. But anyway, IPv4, when it came out decades ago, I don't think they expected there to be 8 or 10 billion people, or however many people we have now, and all these different devices all these companies have and people have, right? All these mobile devices and tablets and IoT and Internet of Things, right? That just wasn't expected. So for a long time now, we've been coming very close to running out of IP addresses. So they designed IPv6. I'm not going to explain IPv6, but the key difference I will mention is IPv4, you have three private IP ranges, and then you have public IPs. IPv6, everything is pub, all IP addresses are public, right? And there's like, I don't know, I maybe I'll look, maybe see if I can Google it real quick, because I probably should have looked this up here. How many IP PV6 addresses are there? Let's see. Okay. 40 trillion. So 340 trillion IPv6 addresses. There are only 4,294,000 and some change IPv4 addresses, right? So under 5 million, but there are 340 trillion IPv6, right? So whenever that does become the world standard, I think the world would end before we ran out of IP addresses. Anyway, so look up what subnetting is, understanding what siders and subnets are, understanding. I would look up what are the typical appliances or devices you see in a company network infrastructure. What are firewalls? What is it when someone says an edge device? What is a failover kit for, a firewall? What are web proxies? What are email proxies? What is a Active Directory, and what is DNS? DNS is basically how the internet runs around the world, or how people are able to find things, access things, right? You have an IP address, and then you have like a website URL, for example. The website URL is just a DNS record. It's just a pointer to an IP address, because that website lives somewhere on some server or servers, right? Somewhere in the world, and they have IP addresses. So a website's true name is really an IP address, IP address, but it's just easier for us to remember and associate with names. So that's where domain name service comes from, DNS, right? Understanding that, what, and then also like understanding concepts like DHCP, Dynamic Host Control Protocol, you know, reassigning and IP addresses and stuff like that. So just look up general entry level IT information. And then, you know, just how networks work and what's usually involved. And once you start getting hearing some of these terms, then go pick individual terms and start digging into those more, right? Like if you come across what is a network sensor or what is an ISP, you know, or, I mean, not ISP, but IPS, what is an intrusion prevention system? Then go dig into that and see what it is. And then, you know, if you, you're not familiar with a web proxy, go Google what that is. And then just start picking terms and start going down that rabbit hole, and you'll start picking up concepts, not realizing how much you're actually learning. that's the first thing. The second thing would be the Security 101 training and stuff like that. So Udemy and LinkedIn Learning and probably even YouTube, they all have cybersecurity 101 training. So get into that because they'll teach you all of the basic concepts that you need to know. So I highly suggest that. I'm actually going to note these three things down because I'm just kind of talking about them. 1 second here. Well, damn it. 1 second. Can't do oh, all right. Let's see. And then yeah, cybersecurity 101 training. And then you know, look up certificates too, and start learning about those because you're not only are you preparing for a certificate, you're also learning a lot of valuable information. Some entry level certificates would be from CompTIA. CompTIA gives a they give a lot of certifications, but Security Plus and Network Plus. Security Plus is typically the certificate that people require for entry level positions. A lot of them will let you get it upon being hired, right? They'll give you like 6 months or a year to get that certification. But Security Plus is the most common one. You can also get Network Plus that'll help you out. Some people get A Plus. That's hardware. So if you're not in a hardware, you can probably bypass A plus. There's no problem. No, you know, it's no big deal there. But you know, then you start getting, you know, what, so use those to, start, you know, your training. So Security Plus and Network Plus, right? Now, if once you're in security and you've been in for a handful of years, then you start looking at more advanced certificates, such as one is a CISSP, or just called CISP. This is really the standard advanced level certificate out there. It's like a, I think it's like a 600 question test or something, I don't know. It's like an all day test. You can take it whenever you want and pass it, but you cannot get your CISP certification until you've been in the field for at least 5 years. And then only then once you meet that requirement, you pass the test and you have 5 years, then you have to have someone that already has their CISP certification to sponsor you, meaning they basically have to say, yeah, this person has been in the field and give them their certificate, right? and then, but then, you know, CompTIA came out with their version of a CISP called CASP, so CASP, you know, a handful of years ago, and that's becoming more widely accepted as well. I don't think it has those stringent requirements like the CISP does, right? But they all do require continuing education, right? But there's plenty of ways to meet that requirement. Yeah, typically if you're looking at engineer architect level roles, if you see CISP on there as a requirement or desired thing, you'll probably also see CASP as an option as well. Another thing I would do is look up security vendors out there, right? So look up Fortinet or CrowdStrike or Splunk. I'm just kind of typing them out as I say them. Splunk or McAfee or Trellix or FireEye. Look up, just look up all these different major security vendors out there and start looking, more importantly, looking at what solutions they give, right? What products do they sell? Because you can start looking up that product and you'll start understanding how security solutions are used, right? You'll start getting an idea what is a centralized logging solution? What tools are usually used in a SOC security operations center? What is a firewall? Knowing that there's a host firewall versus a network firewall, knowing what network IPSs are, knowing what web proxies and email proxies are, knowing all these different solutions, understanding what these companies are selling, that you could go research them and watch videos on them, and not that you're going to know how to use that product, but you'll get an you'll start getting an idea of things out there to consider. Now some roles to look into. Just a list of random, not random, right? But not probably not all inclusive, but some roles out there to look at into. I've already, the for entry level is going to be security administrator or specialist or technician. You're the one basically clicking the buttons on the security product, the AV product or the firewall product, and when somebody says, "I need a rule for this thing," but that's really a great place to start out at. Or you could start out with risk assessments or vulnerability scanning or auditing, right? You'll learn a lot in that role as well, and they usually accept people that are very entry level. You can also look at security networking or software development or engineering. We need developers and engineers, right, to write this stuff and build it. You also have intelligence and threat hunting. I talked about threat hunting and forensics and incident response a little bit earlier. Those are some roles to look into. There are entire companies. If you look up Mandiant, they are a threat hunting slash forensics slash incident response company. Then you have architecture, right? Security architecture, helping companies design their environment and how the security solutions will fit in their environment, right? Consulting, right? So if you could work for a security vendor or some third party where you help security teams at other companies implement solutions or things that they're trying to get done where they may not have the bandwidth to do or the knowledge to do it. Then you can also look at choosing between getting into the government sector or the commercial sector, right? I worked in the government sector for a handful of years, and I've been working in the commercial sector for a handful of years. They both have their pros and cons. You could also look at getting into internships. A lot of these companies will offer internships where they'll hire you out of college. Then you can look at, then once you're down the road, some higher level positions might be like a CISO, a Chief Information Security Officer. That person is usually in charge of the entire security for that environment and the team doing that work, right? So those are some roles and things to consider when you're trying to decide your path. Just get an entry level job. Don't decide your path beforehand. Get an entry level job and then start navigating around and figuring out your role, and where you want to go, right? Yeah, I think that about sums it up. Just kind of see here. Yeah, but if you have any questions about this, about anything I've talked about, you can go to my website, epochsec.io/contact. You can set up a call with me. I actually have a full set of calls next week, which is exciting. But if anybody wants to just talk to me one-on-one, about whatever it is, just let me know. Right. Yeah. Let's see. We'll hang out just for a few more minutes, and then we'll close up and just see if I have anything else to share. Oh, yeah, so my website, epochsec.io again. If you go to the information feed page, or if you just do .io/blog, it'll take you there. I also have my GitBook page. I'll be announcing that later. I have a few more documents to get up there. Basically, my website and my GitBook page will both have the exact same. Every time I write a document, I'll put them on both, so that people can, choose a preference. I also have a call with a blockchain learning to see about incorporating my documentation to the way they format things. So it'll be just maybe possibly another avenue for them to for this information to get out there. Yeah, I'll go on mute. If you're listening to recording, I'm done here. I'm just going to stay on for a couple more minutes to see if anybody hops in, anybody else hops in and needs anything from me. All right, we are done here for the day. I hope.